to the topic of yesterday, you recall that I started speaking about the question, do the remnant need to speak in tongues? And I want to continue with this theme today. As a matter of fact, I've got to tell you what I will speak about on Friday morning. I will speak about the remnant in the book of Daniel. That's not a book that we usually look at when we look at the remnant, but I'll speak on the remnant in the book of Daniel. And I will tell you a few experiences that we had during Nazi Germany when we, as a family, attempted to live the Adventist life and lifestyle in situations where you were immediately identified as a Seventh-day Adventist if you didn't go along with the government policy. I remember there is public school only available to Seventh-day Adventists in Germany, and of course, what we had to do, we had to greet everybody with the so-called German greeting. You know what that was. I didn't do it then, and I won't show you now. So when you went to somebody's home or into a business or to the police station where we had to get permission to visit our aunt, even though she lived only 5 miles away, you were not permitted to travel. Everything was under control. And you would go in and say good morning. They knew that you were not on the right side from their point of view because you had to say something else. And if you say goodbye or have a good day, and they knew again that you were an opponent to that system. So from the very moment that you greeted people, you made a statement about yourself. And we decided we would always greet people in the international greeting rather than in the German greeting. And so we were marked right from the start. And then, of course, the Sabbath was a big problem in school. I will tell you on Friday morning about my principal. My principal for 4.5 years, bless his heart. I don't think he'll make it to heaven, but I'm not the judge. He was a good Nazi principal. He was short, he was fat, which meant he had plenty of food to eat, that which meant that he was in the privileged class. He had a golden swastika in his lapel. If you had a silver one, you were a good Nazi. If you wore a gold one, you were a super good Nazi. And I will tell you on Friday morning how he reacted when my mother said to him that she would like to ask permission for me to have every Saturday off from school because we believe that Saturday is the biblical Sunday. I'll tell you that little story. It was rather fascinating because my mother had made the decision, since my father was already in the army against his will. He was a Seventh-day Adventist minister, and the Lord preserved him, and I'll tell you how he came back. He was in the front lines all the time because he refused to use the weapon. So the German government decided to put him in the front lines, put him in a unit, and that unit was a unit of 2,000 men, all from the same area where I lived, in the city of Frankfurt, and they were all put in an engineering unit to build bridges for the German army to advance. They were always in the front line, every place where they were, and they put my dad there because he wanted to be a medic. They refused him to be a medic because he wouldn't use a gun to defend a wounded German soldier. That was the question that they asked him. So they put him up front, and that unit of 2,000 men, believe it or not, was replaced 3 times. And only 7 of the original survived. And only 3 of the 7 were not wounded, and my dad was one of them. Yes, the Lord can be with his people, you know. And my dad had made up his mind. If the Lord wants me to die, I will die. If the Lord wants me to live, I will live. But I will be faithful to the Lord. Is that what the remnant do? I think that's what the remnant ought to do, to live a lifestyle that is faithful to what Jesus would do in the very circumstance where he's placed us. And wherever he's placed us, he wants us to be faithful. Is that right? And he provides the strength that we need to be faithful as God's remnant people today. Even today, when it is so easy to be an Adventist, and when at the same time it is so tough to be an Adventist because it's so easy. Is that right? Is that right? Well, if you say it's right, it's right. Oh, I need to talk about this book. You know, I was in the ABC and I looked for 10 minutes to find my book. And finally, I asked somebody, where's the book? And the sales lady thought I wanted to buy one. No, I have already several of them. I give them away to my best friends. I got only 10 free copies. I mean, you have to be very careful with those, you know. So you have to be very selective. And if you go into the ABC and go into the second aisle on the right-hand side, it's on the left-hand side. Second aisle right on the left, just in case you have the experience I have. Now, of course, I'm semi-blind, obviously, or I would have seen it right away, because it's very visible. It's black, it's red, it's gold. It's one of the finest books on tongues. I know. So, having told you that I'm biased towards this book, by the way, they have a discount on it, but I forgot what it was. I think it's pretty good, and tax included, they were saying. So that's all I can say about it. If you didn't get your copy for yourself, for a friend, for a loved one, for a neighbor, for somebody whom you know, just to have it available, I can guarantee you that if time should last, speaking in tongues becomes an issue in your congregation too. I can guarantee you. You will be amazed to how many places I'm going throughout the United States and Canada to speak on this particular subject at weekend rallies, speaking on spiritual gifts. Because a lot of Seventh-day Adventists feel they have been left out, they've been left behind by spiritual gifts. They haven't gotten any spiritual gifts, and we need to get what the world has gotten. We are just 10 years behind, or 15 or 20, maybe 90 years behind the others. We finally need to get the gift of the Holy Spirit, and there are some Adventists who believe that we need to speak in tongues. All of us need to engage in miracle healing, and we need to do this in order to be genuine Christian. So a lot of Seventh-day Adventists have renewed questions. And I know, and I'll tell you some secrets, but I will be very circumspect so as not to tell you too much of what I know. But I do know that in the average, where there is a church of 500 or more, that there is a small group that is speaking in tongues in privately, because it's not yet acceptable in the Seventh-day Adventist church. So it is an issue among us, and it is not surprising that it is an issue, because it is the biggest issue in the Christian world at large. And why should Seventh-day Adventists be preserved from being confronted with this kind of a problem? So therefore, towards the end yesterday, by the way, I have to take my watch off again to be sure to close late. So with this, I think I would like to mention a few items again that have been shocking to me over the last 20 years. You know, when there is an issue, my personal attitude in the church is, okay, there's a new point of view, there's a new claim, there's a new something. I think personally, in the sphere of activity where I live, you know, I've been trained to be a biblical scholar. This is my life work. I understand something of the biblical languages, Old and New Testament and other ancient Eastern languages. So it's my task, I believe, to not outrightly reject any idea. Because in the Bible it says we should do what? We should prove and test, right? Test all things, but we need to know the standard of proof. We need to know the standard of test. We need to know where to bring it to, so that we don't measure it on the wrong test, right? So we need to study very carefully various possibilities that may exist or that are coming about. So I am of the mind that is open until I have studied the Word and the Word gives me direction. Then I know which direction to travel. Do you think that's a safe approach? And if the Word should allow two or three possibilities, you know, that is really possible in a few instances in the Bible where there might be a possibility. It might be this way or that way. And you don't know. And I believe this is why God has given us a person who called herself the messenger to the remnant. To then give additional direction, not to change the meaning of the Bible, but to be the lesser light for the greater light, so that we can follow the greater light in the right way. I believe that it's the appropriate use of that kind of gift that the Lord has bestowed upon us. So I believe in that gift, really. I didn't always believe in this gift because I was trained in Germany. And in Germany, Conradi, have you heard about Conradi? Yes, he was one of the great leaders of the Adventist Church. He established really the church powerfully in many parts of Central and Eastern Europe. He wanted to become General Conference President, and he refused in the course of time to believe in Ellen White. As a matter of fact, in 1930, when he crossed the ocean to go to the General Conference in North America, my father had just been working for 5 years under his direction and leadership. He told my father, when I come back, I will be president of the Channel Conference, and I have in my suitcase, and take it with me to the United States, a manuscript against Ellen White. That's right. And Dr. Murdoch, who used to be the dean of the theological seminary for a long period of time, he happened to be on the same boat, because he was in World War II on the right side, and I was in World War II, if you please, on the wrong side. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I was born in the wrong country, on the wrong side of the ocean. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, the government people, you know, suppressed any independent thinking people and wanted to have everybody conform. So I'm a nonconformist, to be honest. I think that's also a biblical principle, isn't that right? We conform to Jesus Christ, but we do not conform to just every cultural norm or every cultural trend that is around us. No. As a matter of fact, we are called as God's remnant people to change the culture in which we live. Is that right? We have a golden opportunity today and have fallen a little bit behind in the right arm of the message. We've fallen a lot behind because there are a lot of people who are saying today what we've been saying a long time, and there are a lot more people today who don't live the real best Adventist lifestyle anymore. Is that true? Or is it only true to the people that I go when they open the fridge, I see all kinds of cans in there? And some are not diet cans? You know what I'm talking about? Just to speak on one little item. So I think the Adventists are called to a great lifestyle. Really. We are called to a fantastic mission. We have a perfect message. Is there anything wrong with the Adventist message? No, there's nothing wrong with the message. Is there anything wrong with the Adventist mission that we have been given by Jesus Christ to proclaim the message to all the world? Is there anything wrong? No. I want to ask the third question. No, I will not. I will not be tempted on Wednesday at 11:25. And you know what the third question is. Are all the saints perfect? No. That's where the problem is, and this is really the issue that is the big issue in the church. People look too much upon people rather than upon Jesus Christ. If we look more on Jesus Christ, we will see ourselves more the way we need to see us. Is that right? And then we can recognize that we still have not reached what Jesus Christ would want us to be, and then we can accept, too, that others haven't reached it yet. And no, we don't need to engage in gossip, but we can help them. Now, I said yesterday morning, and I would like to repeat it, because repetition is the mother of wisdom. That's what my mother said when I was supposed to learn piano. She says, you repeat, you know, repeat and repeat and repeat. And I did repeat for several weeks, and then I gave up against the counsel of my good musician mother. I gave up because I wanted to play an instrument so badly that I had set my mind on. I had set my mind on playing the trumpet. And we lived in an apartment building in which six other families lived. And I played trumpet for 2 hours. You know, there were certain rules in those apartment buildings. From 1 to 3 o'clock, ultimate silence. This is nap time. You cannot even walk down the stairs in such a way that your heels or your shoes could be heard. We took the shoes off to walk down when we wanted to play. Absolute silence. But there was a time when you could play the radio at normal volume, not the high volume we play these days, the normal volume. But still, you know, that would go through the wall and other people had the privilege to listen in. If you talk too loud, so you could never afford an argument that was loud. If you talk too loud, the neighbors could hear all of this. So if you played the trumpet, they had the privilege of participating. And I had played and practiced for 2 hours. It was a horrendous sound that I produced. And five neighbors of the five in the apartment building came and talked to my mother. And they were saying whether this was going to be permanent. And if it was permanent, then either I would have to move, or my family would have to move, or they would have to move, and nobody could move. The message was rather clear, so my mother suggested that I play the piano. And I did not want to play the piano, and I couldn't play the trumpet, so I play nothing. Isn't that stupid? That really is a great mistake on my part. But I was young, and I would not repeat it. So we had a better system for our children. They all play an instrument, and I praise the Lord for that. I said yesterday, there is a myth about speaking in tongues. As a matter of fact, there are 7 myths that people right now accept. I have accepted these myths because I was taught in all of them, just like most everybody is taught in them. But whatever we are taught on this particular subject, there has been such a tremendous amount of factual, sound, well-recognized international research has been done that we have to change our minds on some of these things. Number one, I did say that the speaking of tongues that is practiced today, that the technicians in contemporary world call glossolalia. That's the technical word for what people do in Pentecostalism, neo-Pentecostalism in the charismatic movement. When they speak, this is glossolalic utterance. We commonly refer to that speaking in tongues, using the New Testament language, which they use for the same event. Now, this speaking in tongues that is carried on today among Christians, this glossolalic speech, if you please, is automatically today identified with the experience of that which is described in the New Testament. That identification is a myth. It doesn't hold. Therefore, later today, and we have watched the clock very carefully, we'll quickly have to go and investigate why this is not the case. I'll give you one instance. At Andrews University, we have the best library the church has provided for any of the universities in the field of the humanities and in theology. We've got 1.1 million volumes. So there's a little afternoon reading to do if you enjoy reading. That library has purchased recently a tool to investigate the Greek language that has never existed when I took my doctorate, when I was a student at Andrews. It is only 3 years old, this tool. It is called a CD-ROM. You know what a CD is? Now, it doesn't play music, that particular CD. That CD-ROM has all Greek texts compressed into one CD-ROM. Everything that has ever been found in the Greek language, from the very earliest inscription, the very earliest manuscripts, parchments, writings, to 500 AD, 1200 years. Everything that has ever been written in the Greek language in that period of time from 700 BC to 500 AD is on that CD-ROM. It has a name, Ibicus. I don't know why they gave it the name Ibicus, but when we call for it, we say, oh, we want to have the Ibicus. Then we get one CD-ROM. Can you imagine that there are thousands and tens of thousands of materials on that one item? You can put it in your pocket next to your heart, and you walk around with something that nobody ever possessed. This is a fantastic tool. The price is not too bad, but more than my wife would like to have me invest. Because I have a set budget per year, and I can spend that budget, and then I spend a little more, and when Christmas comes or when I have birthday, I confess. You have to choose your times right. But that CD-ROM costs $5,500. So I have not been able to get this, and I probably will not get it, because it's just too much. But we have put our doctoral students on that CD-ROM, because in the computer you can bring up any word you put in, or and any context and phrase up to a full page. So you not only have the words or phrases, you have the context. You have the document. You just push a button. Can you imagine what people did in 5 or 10 years in the library? You can do right now at home or in that library with that CD-ROM in a matter of minutes. It is fantastic. Can you understand that such a tool would be nice to possess? Now, even my wife is convinced. Only the pocketbook isn't. So, we put students on there and put the word in there that is used in the New Testament, the word for tongues. That's translated into English as tongues. It's the word glossa. G-L-O-S-S-A. Glossa. Whenever you read tongues, we only have 5 texts in the New Testament or 5 passages where that tongue-speaking experience is described. It's not very much. But in those, the word glossa is used every time when your Bible translates tongues. Sometimes they translate the word, even in English, with language or languages. Tongues or language. Okay, so we put our doctoral students to that, and we said, now you go to the CD-ROM and look up every word, and then you translate contextually and find the different meanings for the word glossa. The word to speak in the Greek language is the word laleo. That's easy. Laleo and glossa. Laleo means to speak. Glossa means tongues. Now you know 2 words in Greek that will help you out if the heavenly language is Greek. Glossa and laleo. Do you know what the heavenly language is going to be? Oh, I found out in France. In France, I was at a Bible conference. All the French Adventist ministers came together. And there were several presenters of materials, and I was one of them. And in the morning, just a day like this, at our college in Collage, we walked outside, and 3 younger pastors, with a big smile, you could see that they were facetious, because they knew that I was born in Austria, they knew that I'd grown up in Germany, and the French and the Germans, they have loved each other for centuries so much that they fought 2 or 3 wars each century. So they are, the new generation is on very cordial relations, but the older ones, you know, that's another story. So they asked me, Dr. Hazel, you're an Old Testament scholar, a New Testament scholar, you know the biblical languages, tell us, what is the heavenly language? Now I knew that this was a trick question, I just didn't know what they were hinting at. I could not afford to say French, which they probably thought. I didn't want to say this, because I came from the other side of the river. And they knew I wouldn't do that. And so I said to them, Armenian. Armenian. Because I have some Armenian friends I had in Collegedale, and they literally told me, they believed it, that the heavenly language from whatever back was Armenian. That was a new insight. I hadn't heard that before. So that came in handy. And they said, Armenian? No. Armenian? I said to them, well, if it's not Armenian, what is it? And I'd fallen into the trap. And they said, English. Now, you know the French don't like Americans who speak English in France. I mean, they can all understand when you ask an English question and they respond in French. They want you to learn French. So they said, English. It's a cultural phenomenon. You have to understand the next item you will really understand. Because the French really don't like the English of the Americans to be spoken in France. They believe the French language is one of the finest languages in the world. It's musical, as you know. It has these nasal sounds that we don't know how to make. It's just a gorgeous language. You know what I'm talking about? You've been there? And so they said, English. And I said, why English? Now, why would a Frenchman say English? They said, well, because the Americans don't want to learn anything else. Now, you understand the cultural joke that they've gotten me, all right. Yes. Now, I don't know what the heavenly language is, except that it will be heavenly. So, glossa and laleo, these 2 words we looked up. We wanted to find out what are the ranges of meanings of these 2 words. We wanted to find out, is there any text in the ancient Greek language any place? In the Christian church fathers, in any type of language outside of the New Testament, were speaking in tongues, would mean to speak an unknown language or to speak an angelic language or to engage in sounds that don't make sense, which we call gibberish, something what is happening today. We wanted to find out. And so these doctoral students went through these texts one by one. We printed them out. We subdivided them. They went through them. They translated them. Contextually, we reinvestigated every single instance of the word tongue in glossa, and there are three meanings. Three meanings. One meaning for the tongue, for the word tongue, is the tongue in the human mouth. Just like we have the word tongue. That's the human organ, the tongue in the human mouth is one meaning. That's the most basic and the most widely used meaning. The second meaning for the word tongue is the tongue in a musical instrument. Now we have instruments also where we say there is a tongue. Isn't that right? That's right. We have certain musical instruments where there's a tongue inserted, you blow through, and that tongue vibrates and makes the sound. So that word for tongue already existed way back then for a musical instrument that had a tongue that would vibrate. That's the second meaning. Then there's a third meaning, and that exhausts all the meanings. That information, if you like to have the background, is in this book that I've shown you. The third meaning of the word tongue is language. That's the third meaning. Now, we were looking for a fourth meaning. We were trying to figure out, is there a meaning where speaking in tongues means an unknown language, an unknown speech, something that nobody understands? Is that ever used any place in the Greek language, in any text from all these centuries? And it is never, ever used. Now, you need to take your King James Version that you have in 1 Corinthians 14, and you need to put a square bracket around the little word unknown that is in front of the word tongues in a few instances, only in the King James Version in English. And if you have a good King James Version, that word unknown is printed in italics. That is, in slanted letters, in order to indicate for the knowledgeable reader, whoever reads the introduction to a Bible, that these slanted words in the Bible, they are not in the original text. They have been supplied. They have been added by translators. That's why I say you need to put a square bracket around the word unknown. What Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 12 through 14 has never the word unknown. This is simply in the King James Version, the only Bible in English where this is repeated. It's not in any other Bible in English. It's in no Bible outside of the King James translation. Simply in 1611, when these translators translated the Bible, in a few instances they put the word unknown before it. So you have to discount the word unknown because it ain't there. It is simply a translational interpretation on the part of the translators. It is just not present. This is a fact that we have to keep in mind. So now we are confronted with a new linguistic fact, brothers and sisters, and that is tongues in New Testament times never meant what people practice today. The word tongues was never used for that. It is totally unknown. In other words, if you transport yourself back into the past, when you hear the word tongues, you can think of what every human being or every animal has in his or her mouth, the tongue. You can think of what is in a musical instrument, that's the tongue, or you use the word tongue for language. As a matter of fact, in the German language, I don't know to what degree that's still true in English, but in the German language, people will ask you not how many languages you speak necessarily. They may ask you, how many tongues do you speak? Meaning languages. The word tongues is still used in various languages like this today, just like it was used then. So if we wanted to be careful in our translation according to the usage of the word that was known in New Testament times, when we read to speak in tongues, you can put an equation sign there and say, speak in languages. Speak in a language. That was the only meaning that these people knew. There was nothing else. Another myth that I have to tell you about And the second one was invented by Germans. Now, I can say this because I'm a Kraut myself, by background. So I have no, but it was invented by a German scholar at the end of the last century, the beginning of the century, in which he interpreted a religious experience that took place in a city about 50 miles away from ancient Corinth, the city of Delphi. In Delphi, there was a famous sanctuary. And in the sanctuary in Delphi, there were priestesses who would give you or give the people in the past some oracles. You know, if you wanted to know the future, you could go to those priestesses, sacrifice to their gods, and then ask the priestess or the one of the priestesses, ask a question. This is known as the Oracle of Delphi. Ask a question. Will my mother-in-law live yet for a long time? Will my child that is sick become well? Will my husband who has been lost on the ocean now for a week come back? They would ask questions like this. And the German scholar that wrote about this said that the priestess spoke in tongues. Now this is not true. There's no Greek text, no text ever says that they spoke in tongues. He simply claimed that the priestess spoke in tongues. And then there needed to be a translator who told you what the tongues meant. The actual fact is that the priestess would ask you, if you would have lived then, would have been a pagan, and you would have gone there and would have asked the question, the priestess would have asked you, in fact, do you want that written out, the answer, or do you want it just orally from me? That's what the priestess had asked. In other words, they wrote many of these responses out, and it was normal Greek. There was nothing secretive about it. She would also ask a second question, would you like to have it written out in prose, or do you like a poem? Isn't that interesting? Now, these priestesses were no dummies. They could write poetry. So they were very intelligent women. So they could write it in poetry or in prose. They could speak it in poetry or in prose. You had your choice. But they would give it in a kind of a parable form. So if you would ask, you know, would my husband come back, you know, who's lost? She would say something like this. Big waves are in the ocean. The waves are becoming bigger and bigger. And then there's a big event. And then the waves calm down. And finally, the sun rises in the east. Now, is your husband coming home or not? You see? It's mysterious. It is not clear. So you would go now to an interpreter and say, this is what she has written out for me, or this is what she told me. Tell me what it means. And the interpreter would interpret that parable and make it meaningful. Say, well, you will come back, whether you have a chance to come back, or, you know, no, the sun is rising in the east, but, you know, something else. Whatever. That was the Oracle of Delphi. There was no speaking in tongues the way we know speaking in tongues today at the Oracle of Delphi. The word speaking and the word tongues isn't even used. But there is an interpreter, just like we have an interpreter in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, but ours is different from that one. I would like to mention another item that is important. There is no evidence from the ancient world, regardless of how many books you read on the history of speaking in tongues, but there's no evidence from the ancient world that anybody ever did then what people do today. There's no evidence. Not one evidence from any culture, any language, or anything. Now, I'll tell you what my assumption is. I have an assumption. It's an unproven assumption. It's just an idea. Throw it away. My idea is that people then could do what these people already do today, what people do today again, but we just don't have a record of it. That's my assumption. We don't have a record. But still, the fact is, what the people did in New Testament times and were told to do, to speak in tongues, is not identical to what people practice today. The fact is that in 1901, speaking in tongues, the way we understand it today, originated Before 1901, most of the commentators on 1 Corinthians 12 through 14 said that speaking in tongues is the gift, the miraculous gift of speaking a foreign language that God had given to proclaim the gospel news. Once this interpretation, or once the new situation happened here in North America, in Kansas City it started, moved to Azusa Street in Los Angeles, moved from there to the whole world, and is now a practice of 370 to 400 million Christians around the world. Protestants, Catholic, Greek, Orthodox, you mentioned them, and goes beyond Christianity, as I said yesterday. Now we need to know, I wanted to know, I need to know, for myself, for the clarification of my mind, if a person in Japan, where I was just about a year ago, and I inquired about it, whether it's true, because you read and you want to find out, is it really so? You read it in authoritative literature, scholarly literature, you go there, you say, is that so? Is that so? There is a sorcerer's sect, a sect that engages in sorcery. And every member of that sect speaks in tongues. It is a non-religious sect. That is, a non-Christian sect. It is a Buddhist, Shintoist sect. And everybody speaks in tongues. Now, what I want to know is, when they speak in tongues, I want to have a tape recording, or have somebody take tape recordings and take them to the best linguists that have investigated linguistically what is happening when people speak in tongues, Christians and non-Christians, to tell me whether what they do in their religious exercises is identical to what Christians do in their religious exercises. I want to know. Is that wrong? No, this is very important to me. Because I want to know whether the phenomenon in the Western world and in Christianity as speaking in tongues is the same phenomenon as what is happening outside of Christianity. I want to know. The fact is that these tape recordings have been made over the last 20 years. That the best linguists have investigated these tape recordings for Christians and non-Christians. Professor Goodman of the University of Illinois spent 2 decades of her life doing that. She is one of the world's most important experts, has published several books and numbers of articles. Oodles, whatever that word means. It's not in the dictionary. So, she did this. Professor Samarin, who is the head of the linguistics department at the University of Toronto, a Canadian, he's done the same thing. He's published a book in 1971, big, heavy book, which had such an influence on tongue-speaking Christians, on the Pentecostals and Neo-Pentecostals, had such an influence on Oral Roberts that they changed the biblical interpretation. Yes? He took thousands of tape recordings of Christians, thousands of them. English-speaking people who speak in tongues, French-speaking people who speak in tongues, Spanish-speaking people, Portuguese-speaking people, German-speaking people who speak in tongues, to find out whether there's any variation among them. No variation. No matter what your initial language is, when people speak in tongues, it's the same for everybody. He wanted to find out, linguistically, what do they say? Is this related to any language that is known? Does it have language structure? Professor Goodman of the University of Illinois did the same thing. Does it have language structure? Because every language in the world is structured. You may not understand the language, but you can still recognize the structures, the sound patterns. So they investigated in the spectrograph the sound patterns. And the sound patterns and the structure of what is happening in speaking in tongues, respectively, glossolalia, in the Christian and non-Christian world, they concluded independently in many different studies, also others who investigated, has nothing to do with any language that anybody ever speaks today or that anybody ever spoke in the past. So what is happening when you go to a Pentecostal meeting and you hear people speaking in tongues, it is not a human language. It is what they say, what you hear, the phenomenon of glossolalia has nothing to do with the language of the present or the past. Now we have some very interesting seminary students. I did not do this. But I could very well imagine that I would have done it. They went to some Pentecostal meeting, some of our African students, and wanted to test the interpretation of tongues. Because when tongue speakers are there, frequently there's somebody who can interpret. Now, these Adventist seminary students don't speak in tongues, but they do speak very rare African dialects that they know nobody in the United States knows. So at the right time, when people speak in tongues, they too speak in their tongue, in their language. And they recite the Lord's Prayer. Now they did this. They simply recite the Lord's Prayer. Our Father which art in heaven, you know, in their language, in their local dialect. And what happened time and again, now I don't recommend that they do this, but what happened time and again, that some brother and sister in that congregation who has got the gift of interpretation says, oh, here's a new brother who is speaking in tongues and the Lord has shown me what he says. None of the interpreters ever said that they spoke the Lord's Prayer. None, ever. They are simply saying, one that I recall, that one student related to us in a public meeting, he said, oh, this interpreter said that I was praising God for a successful fundraising campaign that will just be held in this congregation. Now, you connect the Lord's Prayer with a successful fundraising campaign. It takes a lot of imagination. So here is a discrepancy between what is happening and what is being interpreted. In my book, I have excerpts of published material where a scientist, Professor Kildall, one of the finest specialists in that area, has deliberately taken one person who spoke in tongues, took that one tape recording, and played it in the knowledge and told them that this is an experiment to different people who have the gift of speaking, of interpreting the tongues. He says, I have one speech in tongues. I don't know what it is. It comes from this meeting. Gave him all the detail. And he says, I'm doing a scientific experiment. I would like you to give me the interpretation of this tongue speaking. Tell me what it means. I record it. And I will do this with five other people who have the same gift. I would like to find out whether all of you agree in the interpretation, whether what is being said can really be interpreted to have meaning. He did this, Professor Kildall. He writes it up. And he got five different interpretations. He went back to each one, played the tongue-speaking speech again, played that person's interpretation and the interpretations of everybody else, and said, can you explain this to me? It's a scientific experiment. And he got, surprisingly, from each of the interpreters the same response. Each one said, well, this is what the Lord told me it means. Which means that one tongue speech has multiple meanings, depending on the interpreter, but it's not one message in any single one. So there is no correlation, scientific correlation, between communication and interpretation. This is totally open. This is a real serious problem today. As a matter of fact, due to these studies, Oral Roberts and other major tongue-speaking exponents have changed their interpretation of the Bible. Up until these publications became widely known, circulated, and read, they were saying, we are speaking some kind of an obscure, ancient, or modern language that is spoken somewhere, and somebody will understand it whenever we find, you know, who speaks those languages. This is no longer done today. Today they are saying, when we speak in tongues, we speak the language of angels. Now what we need to do is get some tape recordings of angel speech, investigate the speech pattern, do the same thing. But since angels don't speak to us like this, this experiment has not been done and probably cannot be done. But they say in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 1, is the proof that it is the speech of angels. Now, if you have your Bible, I'd like to invite you to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 1. This is the famous chapter on the love of God. As we all know, it's one of the most sublime chapters. And in the opening verse, Paul is making a rather fascinating statement. I'll read it from the New American Standard Bible. It doesn't matter which Bible you read from. The sentence should begin with an if. This one says, "If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I have become something that's worthless." Right? This is an if clause. Now I become rather technical in my language. It's an if sentence. Since I have children in school, all three of them, two in college, one doing a PhD, there is various needs. My daughter recently was in an accident and ruined her car that the parents provided for her. The parents cannot provide right now insurance that would cost us $5,000 a year because they are so young. So we don't have all the cars insured that they would be replaced. We also learned out of previous experience that your insurance jumps so high if there's an accident that you might as well save the money up and then pay for it when an accident comes anyway. So we have minimal legal insurance, but nothing fancy like you have for your nice cars. So my daughter was in a wreck, and her car is ruined. She needs a car. She needs to go to work. Or father has to be a taxi driver. Mother has to be a taxi driver, and we have not been trained to be taxi drivers. So our training lies in other spheres of experience of life. So therefore, we couldn't do that. So we have to replace this vehicle, repair it, replace it. And so we made some stipulation. If we get the car repaired or if we replace the car, will you, if, you know, it's if, it's an if clause. You know what an if clause is? It's a stipulation. If you do this, we will do this. Is that right? And if you don't do this, we won't do this. That's an if clause. Now we have wonderful children. And they always agree with us when it's to their advantage. Like all human beings do. We all agree when it's to our advantage, isn't it? I mean, let's be honest with ourselves. So, sure, we took care of that problem and the if stands. Now, in Greek, there are four different if clauses. And they can be detected on the basis of the verbal form. Number one, on the kind of if. There are two kinds of ifs. In English, we are very impoverished. As a matter of fact, we have a very rich language. We have 800,000 words. That's a very rich language. But syntax in English is limited. Now, Greek has a very extensive syntax. It's a fascinating. This is why ministerial students, once they have passed their Greek class, they think they are ready for translation. So the syntax, there are four if clauses. Every ministerial student learns these four if clauses. And this if clause that is used here is an aan with a subjunctive. Now you know what that means, Frank, because Frank has knowledge of this. An aan with a subjunctive, aan if with a subjunctive following, there's a subjunctive following, means that this is an if clause that is an unreal if. That is, if we want to translate this in the correct English way, we would translate it, if I were able to speak in tongues of men and angels, which I'm not able to, and wouldn't have love, it would mean nothing. You see the point? So you cannot use this text to say that Paul believes that he speaks in the tongues of men, and he speaks in tongues, according to chapter 14, and the tongues are tongues of angels. Doesn't work. The if clause rules that possibility out. Paul is not making here a claim that he speaks in the tongues of angels as well. It is a if clause that denies the reality of the possibility, just to make a point. Is that difficult to understand? If it's not difficult, maybe I've made the point. In other words, our Pentecostal, neo-Pentecostal and charismatic friends, which I like them very much, they're nice people. They're sincere people. Doesn't mean that they are right on this point, but they're good people, many of them. They have no biblical basis for the claim that they are making today. They have no biblical basis for the claim that speaking in tongues is just a foreign language that they speak. No such tape recording has ever been made in the last 25 to 30 years when investigations by the tens of thousands have been made. They have no basis that they speak in the language of angels. They simply have to admit that they are making sounds that cannot be explained as any language that has ever existed in the past and in the present. So what they are speaking today has no relationship with what the New Testament says. Nothing whatsoever. In the New Testament, speaking in tongues means one thing and one thing only. It's not the conclusion that many scholars want to reach for chapter 14 in 1 Corinthians, but it still is a fact. The Ibicus proves it. There are many other indications and proofs for this. And that is, when speaking in tongues is mentioned, it is the miraculous gift in the New Testament that all of a sudden, by the power of the Holy Spirit, as a miracle, people could speak another human language to communicate the gospel, to convert the people. And that gift, Ellen White says, was a permanent gift. And then she adds that this gift made it possible for the disciples to speak another foreign language miraculously on a continuous basis. And listen now, she says, without an accent. You know now I don't speak in tongues. I did not receive that miraculous gift. I have learned the English language, I still learn it, and I have a very, very nice accent as far as I'm concerned. If you don't like it, join me. So there is a real, real serious issue here. There is one definition in the Bible, in the New Testament, that defines speaking in tongues. It is in Acts 2. And we cannot separate Acts 2 from the same language that is used in 1 Corinthians 14. In 1 Corinthians 14, brothers and sisters, there were Christians in the early church who misused the right gift. Just as if I were to speak to you in Greek or in Hebrew or in Aramaic or in German or in my German dialects that I have learned, would speak to you, what benefit would it be to you? Would only benefit me. And the Lord would understand it. But you wouldn't understand it. And so there were people in the Corinthians church, a whole bunch who came up front and spoke simultaneously with the excitement of having received that new gift to the congregation, and it didn't benefit anybody because there was nobody there who spoke Phoenician or who spoke that particular language that they spoke. They were to use that for these people who spoke those languages. It was a misuse of the gift. And this is why Paul can say, I wish you all would speak more than I do speak in tongues, in languages. And that's why he says one and two and three in turn. And only if a translator is there so that everybody can benefit. That is the picture that he paints. But in Acts 2, and today I do go over, only two more minutes. If you have to go, please go, because the dinner has to be ready for all your friends. In Acts chapter 2, there is the interpretation. You can't miss it in verse 6. And when this sound occurred, Acts 2:6, and when this sound occurred, the multitude came together and they were bewildered because they were each one hearing them, the disciples, the 120, speak in his own language. That was the gift. There were people out there who heard the 120 who were in the upper room, who had received the Holy Spirit, had received the gift now to communicate the gospel. They could hear them speak in their own language. So this was the gift of speaking miraculously a foreign language. My, did I ever wish, when I studied my languages for my different programs, did I ever wish that the Lord would give me that gift? Did I ever wish, when I memorized these thousands of vocabularies, and all that syntax. But that's what the Lord has chosen to do, that task at that time. And we have to let the Lord allow to make his own choice. In verse 8 they say again, and how is it that we each hear them in our own language to which we were born? How is it? They were surprised. And at the end of the day, how many were baptized? 3,000. The Lord has given a gift of speaking in tongues, a gift of miraculously communicating the gospel in another language so that people would be baptized. He didn't give a gift that nobody could understand.
So that's the difference. And my time being up, I will have to close today. I only regret that we don't have question-answer periods at the 11 o'clock hour. Have you heard the story? You've heard the story of the famous physics professor who was old and really ancient and not so strong anymore, who was traveling around and giving his lectures. And after the lectures, of course, these physics experts, you know, asked very, very tough questions. And the driver that he had with him, who drove him around the country, he noticed that the old gentleman was getting very wearied and tired. And so he said to him, you know, the next place we go to, why don't you allow me to give the lecture and you just relax in the back? They don't know how you look. And the physics prof said, well, this can't be done. He says, yes, I've memorized it. And he started to recite, did a fantastic job. He says, no, it's the questions afterwards. When the questions come, what do you say? Oh, he said, I've noticed they ask the same kind of questions. And you are giving these responses. So he recited them. And the old man was so worn out, he said, okay. Sure enough, he gave a splendid presentation to everybody. And the applause was big. And the questions came and he responded. And there was this one expert in the audience. One of the world's most important physics experts. And he asked a tough question that had never been asked before. So he said, oh, sir, this is no problem. My driver back here will answer your question. I wish sometimes we had question-answer period. And I wish sometimes that I would have a driver around so that some things could be answered that we don't have answers for. God bless you.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries have been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.